Well, last time we were together, we were looking at Reformed Orthodoxy, really Reformed Orthodoxy post-John Calvin. And we focused our attention primarily on Reformed Orthodoxy that was occurring and developing within continental Europe. We will focus on the British Isles beginning next week. But we looked at some of the major developments that occurred post-Calvin. We looked at the rise of Reformed Scholasticism and really its alternative in the Reformed world, and that was Raymondism. We looked at many of the theologians that were very vital in developing Reformed Orthodoxy post-Calvin, looking at Theodore Beza, looking at Polanus, looking at Francis Turretin and others. And so we really began to grasp some of the major developments that were occurring within the Reformed world after Calvin. But just like Lutheranism, Reformed Orthodoxy dealt with its share of controversy as well. It was not just this clean-cut, perfect, clear picture of what Reformed Orthodoxy was, though it had to deal with its controversies as well. And unlike the Lutheran controversies, the Reformed controversies really continue to stretch into today. These two primary systems of thought are very much characterized many people's beliefs today. And so this is a fascinating reality, as primarily Amaraldianism is still very much a part of the context and discussion in the Reformed world, whereas obviously Arminianism is seen as totally divorced from Reformed theology, but is still a very common theology amongst others today, especially when you start thinking of original Wesleyanism and things like that. And so, very, very important discussions tonight, as these two controversies, Arminianism and Amaraldianism, very much are still central to theological discussions today. And I want to begin our discussion of these Reformed controversies by looking first and foremost at the Arminian controversy. The Arminian controversy. Well, Arminianism takes its name from Jacob Arminius. He was born in the Dutch Republic, and his parents and family were all killed by Spanish soldiers when he was very young during the bloody war for Dutch independence. So obviously Spain had a big chokehold on the Dutch Republic. The Dutch Republic rises up in its provinces to fight for independence. And ultimately, that very much ended up being the case. Dutch Republic did gain its independence. But through that war, Arminius lost literally his entire family. He became orphaned, and that was a really hard part of the beginning parts of his life. The young orphaned Arminius was taken by a generous patron and wealthy Dutch linguist and mathematician, a man by the name of Rudolf Snellius. And Snellius made sure that Arminius had the best possible education that you could have at this time. And during his studies, Arminius actually traveled to Geneva for a year, where he would study under Theodore Beza. And in 1587, after his studies finished, Arminius traveled back to the Dutch Republic and was ordained a Dutch Reformed pastor serving a congregation there in Amsterdam. Now, it seems that Arminius began to think of the Reformed understanding of predestination and human freedom as something very difficult, and he would even doubt the system proposed by Beza, primarily the supralapsarian system, but really in many ways rejected the concept of just an unconditional predestination, an unconditional election of God, totally. It's important to note, however, that this was not something that was just novel to Arminius, primarily within the Dutch Republic. There were many within the Dutch Republic that also had kind of debated and argued against the more Calvinistic, either infralapsarian or supralapsarian forms of predestination. And the primary reason for that was the way in which Erastian or Erasmus was so influential in the Dutch Republic. Erasmian humanism really remained a huge part of Dutch Protestantism. And it focused on more on practical morality and spirituality rather than doctrinal theology. And the reason why that's important is because when your entire framework is built more on spirituality and on praxis and action and doing and service and work, it is always going to stress more on the side of human freedom and dignity. And that was very much the case with this Erastian influence on the Dutch Reformed Church, especially early on in many of the forms of Dutch Protestantism. And so this Erastian influence was seen throughout, but Arminius was really a vocal and probably the top intellectual theologian to really put forth his own views of predestination, his own views of election that also fit well with an Erastian humanism. Now, the seeds of doubt were further sown into Erasmus' mind regarding predestination when he read the Dutch Catholic humanist, a man by the name of Dirk Kornhert. Now, Kornhert was a key player in launching the Dutch independence. He was one of the major characters. It's important to remember that many of the battles within the fight for Dutch independence was not merely Dutch Protestants versus Spanish Catholics, but also Dutch Catholics versus Spanish Catholics. This was more of a nationalistic movement, which is something that's extremely common in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, is this rise of nationalism. Now, Kornhert also, not only was this great political strategist and leader of the independence, he also dabbled in theology, where he began to advocate for a concept of human free will that gave it virtual autonomy from divine grace. And so as where individuals like Calvin had taught for a creaturely free will, that is to say that man is free as it pertains to actions among fellow creatures, but when it pertains to the Creator, God's autonomy, God's freedom, always supersedes creaturely freedom. Well, for Kornhert, it was quite the opposite. Both human autonomy and divine autonomy were really almost on the same foot, per se. And this was very influential to Arminius as well. Now, Kornhert expressed his views primarily through critiquing Theodore Beza's superlapsarian predestination. And the Dutch Reformed Church asked Arminius to actually write a defense for his former professor. So here, Arminius is a part of the Dutch Reformed Church. The Dutch Reformed Church is predominantly Reformed in its orthodoxy, very much in line with the superlapsarianism of Theodore Beza, even though we'll see at the Synod of Dort, it took a much more infralapsarian approach. Nevertheless, it comes to Arminius, who was a student under Beza, and says, hey, this Catholic is attacking Beza. You need to write a defense of him. He's your former professor. You know him better than us, so you need to write a defense for him. However, as Arminius began to study the issue, he was put off by Beza's high superlapsarian views of predestination and actually became more inclined to support Kornhert's criticism. Now, for the next 14 years, Arminius continued to develop in a direction away from his traditional Reformed orthodoxy. And another influential person that came into Arminius' framework of study was the writings of the Roman Catholic theologian Luis de Molina on human freedom, divine foreknowledge, and sufficient grace. Molina's system would be later known as Molinism. And when we look at some of the developments that happened in Reformed Catholicism, probably a month or two from now, we will look more at Molinism in depth. But Molina, who also, I should argue, is very influential today, I think you can see this in like William Lane Craig, has proposed a form of Molinism and others, but we will look more at that later on. But Molina was also vital in coming into Arminius' framework and helping him as far as in his writings for Arminius to begin framing and articulating his doctrine of predestination and his views therein. Arminius argued the five following points. First, he argued that God's election was conditional on human faith. That is to say, that God looks through the corridors of time in the beginning and before the foundation of the world. God looks through all of time and he foresees, that's what his view of foreknowledge is, he foresees everyone that will believe in him. And so he elects everyone that he already knows will believe in him by faith. This choosing to believe was not caused by grace, but by a cooperation with the divine will and the human will. The term for this we call is synergism. That the divine will and human will work together to cooperate, bringing about the salvation of the individual. Now, contrary to popular belief, and I know many of you who are Calvinists like myself will be shocked to hear this, but Arminius still argued for total depravity. He argued that all men are naturally enslaved to sin. However, the difference between Arminius' system and the more Calvinistic system is that Arminius argued, though all men are totally depraved, fallen, unable to go to God on their own, that God, by his common grace, had restored a measure of liberty to the fallen will of all men to be able to repent and believe if they chose to. The idea that this began to take, the name for this, was that of prevenient grace. That God had given just enough grace to all mankind as to sufficiently make them able to at least repent and believe. They were totally depraved, but God in his prevenient grace has given all mankind a sufficient ability simply to repent and believe. And he would add further grace upon the basis of that faith and repentance. Also, he argued that this reality, this concept of prevenient grace was very important because ultimately there were some individuals who would believe but also not persevere. And this area of perseverance, eternal security, whether once you are saved, will you remain saved, this would always be a stumbling block for many of the Arminian camp. The idea is, can one lose salvation? And when we get to the Remonstrants, we'll see that this was an area that was really left open-ended. That it wasn't, you can lose your salvation or you won't lose your salvation. It was, well, you can possibly lose your salvation. So this was always an area, primarily when it comes to the perseverance of the saints, or this concept of eternal security was an area that was very vague for them. And I think it's pretty clear why that's the case. Now, the controversy began after really Arminius began to gain some pretty influential supporters, not only in the Dutch Reformed Church, but also in the Dutch government. His most eminent backer in the church was a man by the name of Jan Uytenbogaert, who was a preacher in the Dutch capital whose congregation was filled with Dutch nobility. And it was through Uytenbogaert that these Arminian views not only were really became central to really the major metropolitan areas there in the Dutch Republic, but also became really essential in permeating the Dutch nobility as well as some of the Dutch political leaders. His primary political backer was a man by the name of Johan van Oldenbarnevelt, who was a major leader and in the richest province of the Dutch Republic. And the richest province of the Dutch Republic during this time was the province of Holland. Now, these major supporters, both the political supporters and the church supporters, secured Arminius' theology professorship at Leiden University. Now, this is what, and we'll investigate this a little further later, but this was one of the major issues of Arminius. Arminius's theology, of course, obviously was debated, but he was always fairly consistent with that. One of the areas that Arminius seemed inconsistent was his integrity. Leiden University, the senior theology lecturer, was a man by the name of Francis Gomarus. Now, Gomarus was highly supralapsarian, highly predestinarian, very, really a central tenet of Reformed orthodoxy. And so, the Arminius had to interview with Gomarus prior to being selected for the theology professorship. And come to find out, one of the areas that he was able to kind of use his supporters for, both his church supporters and his political supporters, was that the questions were arranged in such a way that Gomarus would ask questions that were very roundabout. Like, for instance, you know, do you believe in God's predestination? Well, Arminius would say, well, yes, of course I do. But that would not be given definition. He wouldn't say, I believe God's predestination is based upon looking through the corridors of time and seeing God and God's foreknowledge or foreseeing of human fate. And so this was something that would actually serve this kind of twofold response, almost what seemed to be two-faced, is what greatly angered Gomarus after the fact. And you can't be surprised by that. Here, Francis Gomarus is this major leader in Reformed Orthodoxy, and all of a sudden, his new theology professor, he's finding out around, you know, after the fact, is proposing ideas that are radically contrary to the Reformed Orthodox that he himself holds and wants Leiden University to champion. So immediately, Gomarus becomes a staunch opponent of Arminius after the fact of Arminius has already been hired. You can imagine, most of that is not only because Gomarus does indeed disagree with Arminius, but also because he sees that he's had the wool pulled over his eyes, right? Like, this person has basically put on two faces. He has gotten this position, and all of a sudden now he's teaching something that is against Reformed Orthodoxy. The university there at Leiden became a theological arena for gladiators and drove a clear wedge of division in the university and soon in the Dutch Reformed Church. In a fruitless attempt to try and restore peace, the Dutch government now became involved in the controversy, as this became really a big deal, and the Dutch Reformed Church was really being divided, primarily the universities, over this issue of Arminianism and obviously Reformed Orthodoxy. The two men, Gomarus and Arminius, debated several times amongst and in front of the civil authorities. However, most of the civil authorities sided with Arminius. But this had little to do with their theological stances regarding the doctrine of predestination. And more, because Arminius believed that the state should have more power over the church, whereas Reformed Orthodoxy believed that the church should always remain independent of the church. And so this really was the main area why the civil authorities so often favored Arminianism over Reformed Orthodoxy, because Arminianism gave the state power over the church. And so the political leaders really kind of backed Arminius, whereas the overwhelming majority of the Dutch Reformed clergy sided with Gomarus and Reformed Orthodoxy. However, before the conflict could end, or really reach any major resolution, Arminius died of tuberculosis in 1609. He was only 49 years of age. For the most part, Arminius was considered a pious man throughout his life, who was a good preacher, a talented debater. But like I said, the biggest question mark regarding Arminius was his integrity. Here was a man that for the entirety of his life subscribed to both the Belgic Confession and the Heidelberg Catechism, while at the same time teaching doctrines that were staunchly opposed to the two. And that really was the major issue here, was how can you subscribe to confessions? This was Gomarus' big argument. How could you take this job? How could you say you believe these things, and yet you are teaching radically opposed doctrines? Yet, one thing that we can say is about Arminian was that he was consistent. Even though you may say, well, his integrity was off there, nevertheless, he consistently insisted that his views did not contradict the Belgic Confession and the Heidelberg Catechism. Now, if you know those two confessions of faith, you would say, yeah, right, it's very in contradiction. But Arminius, whether it was just out of folly or simply just being not very honest, he remained consistent that he did not in any way contradict those two important confessions to the Dutch Reformed Church. But Arminius' controversy, this Arminian view, did not die with really its major founder. Rather, it was carried on by his followers, by really major leaders in the Dutch Reformed world. It by no means stopped with Arminius' death, but really were carried on by three major leaders of the Arminian camp. These were Conrad Vorstius, Simon Episcopius, and most importantly, probably the most well-known of the Arminian leaders, was a man by the name of Hugo Grotius. Now, like I said, Grotius was by far the most influential of these three Arminian leaders. And today, he's still very recognized and very well-known for his contributions to philosophy and really to international law. Vorstius was much more radical compared to the other two, and Simon Episcopius, I always get his last name just jacked up, Episcopius, he was much more kind of the mild-mannered leader. You can almost think Melanchthonian in a lot of ways, more mild-mannered, very quiet. And he was really kind of the leading voice for the Remonstrants, or the Arminian camp, at the Synod of Dort. And we'll look at that a little bit later on. Grotius was very vital, like I said, to this, and not only primarily because of just his philosophical prowess and his treaties on international law, but really also because of the political and intellectual weight that he carried amongst the Dutch people, and primarily within the world of the political nobility. Grotius was seen as kind of the elite scholar of the aristocratic society there in the Dutch Republic. But it was also during this time that Grotius pioneered a new view of the atonement. And this view was the view known as the moral government view of the atonement, which provided an alternative to the penal substitutionary view championed by Lutheranism and Reformed Orthodoxy. This view, this moral government view, argued that God did not punish sin out of any attribute of retributive justice, but only from his loving concern to maintain good order in the moral universe. For Grotius, sin had upset the harmony and happiness of the universe, and it had to be deterred. So in this view, Christ's death did not satisfy God's personal justice. God's personal justice, God's personal wrath was not propitiated in this sense, but was rather a public demonstration, a public exhibition of God's opposition to sin, demonstrating what all sin truly deserved in order that God could pardon the repentant without fostering any illusion about the heinousness of sin. So really kind of just summing this moral government view, the idea is that sin came, broke the harmony of the world. It is what robs this good creation of its harmony and its happiness. And so Christ's death served as the picture of just how serious God takes sin, showing what all sin truly deserves. But God still can forgive sins because He chooses to do so. His justice does not have to be satisfied. And so really, if you want to try to grasp this concept in really a simple idea, it's that for Grotius, God's grace and mercy, triumph are vastly more important than His justice. So God does not have Christ crucified on the basis of His justice being met, His demands of justice being met, but simply just as a display of what sin truly deserves, but also how heinous it is, how horrible sin truly is, because the God-man would have to die for it, but nevertheless, He doesn't really put anyone else's sin on Jesus. That's just simply a display of how bad sin really is. Now you can imagine some of the issues that immediately run into there. What was truly propitiated then at Calvary? What was it? And I think that what Grotius would say was that what was propitiated at Calvary was simply God's demand that sin's heinousness be displayed. God's wrath against sin needed to be displayed to the world, and that was what was appeased at Calvary. Not a sense of personal justice, where sin has been afflicted as an attack and an affront on a holy God. Rather, it was simply, He was appeased that His hatred of sin was shown to the world. I think that is what the moral government view would argue as what was truly propitiated there at Calvary. But with the leadership of these three men and others, the Arminian party, a year after Arminius' death, published really their primary theological manifesto. And this manifesto was titled The Remonstrance. And in this remonstrance, they set out their distinct beliefs in opposition to Reformed orthodoxy in five major points. The first point was that of conditional election. They argued that God had purposed to save or elected those to whom He would save based upon those He foreknew or foresaw in this case, all who would believe and persevere by faith to the end. And so this is really a good bet for God. God elects everyone that He sees will not only believe, but will also persevere. So the elect are those who God saw through the corridors of time, who not only will believe in Him, but persevere to the end in faith. Secondly, they argued for kind of an unlimited or an unconditional atonement. They argue that Christ purchased salvation equally for all. Everyone has died for the same amount, but this salvation is only enjoyed through faith. Third, and what is once again probably shocking to many who have wrongly heard this, as this was a later development of Arminianism, but they argued for total depravity. All of the early Arminians believed in total depravity. They believed man was fallen and could not come to God on his own, that they were born in original sin and dead in Adam. The difference, once again, was this idea of prevenient grace and resistible grace. And those two things went hand in hand. This idea, like I said, what we saw with Arminius, was that God has bestowed prevenient grace on all mankind that is sufficient for their salvation. But this grace can be resisted. You can resist it. It's given to everybody, but you can resist this grace and ultimately reject this grace. This was the idea of prevenient grace. And then finally, like I said earlier, there was the possibility of losing salvation. Some Arminians believed that you would remain saved till the end. Others weren't so sure about that. And I think, you know, I think what maybe it was John MacArthur or someone else, I think, said it right, was the idea is that if you can resist it, if you can choose it, you can lose it. And so this really was where Arminianism always kind of continued to just sit on the fence on that issue of whether or not salvation, primarily as it pertains to the security of salvation, was something that could truly be assured for the believer, or if it was something that could be resisted, just like prevenient grace. You can resist this, ultimately reject it, and fall away into apostasy. So those were really the 5 points of the Remonstrance, the 5 points of Arminianism. This Remonstrance was drafted up by Utenbogert and was signed by 41 pastors and 2 teachers at Leiden State College for pastoral training. The Arminians became known by their statement of faith. They became known as the Remonstrance, and their opponents, the Calvinists, the Reformed Orthodoxy, became known as the Counter-Remonstrance. It's important, though, that we realize that the church and state during this time, church-state relationships, were really vital in promoting this controversy. This controversy was not primarily, was not solely theological. But it's really important to realize, like we looked at with Arminius, that the Remonstrance was really a pro-state movement. That is, the Arminians called for the church to be subordinate to the state, whereas the counter-remonstrants, the Calvinist remonstrants, continued to argue for the independence of the church from the state. Grotius argued that the state should allow all forms of Christian preaching, really one of the first statements regarding religious liberty and tolerance. He believed that all Christian preaching should be tolerated as long as the Trinity was recognized. So that really was the main point of doctrinal orthodoxy for Grotius. You have to believe in the Trinity. If you believe in the triune God of heaven, as ascribed to in the early confessions, then you should be allowed to preach with tolerance and liberty. The only preachers that should be outlawed by the state, according to Grotius, were those who were polemicists, or those who showed intolerance to other preachers. And so you can see how this would, how this could immediately become a shaky ground in many ways. You can imagine that the civil authorities very much were sided with the Remonstrants on this issue. They were going to side with anyone who granted them political power. But it's also fascinating that really the divide between the remonstrants and the counter-remonstrants can also be seen kind of in a class divide. Most of the upper class and the aristocratic parts of the Dutch society were on the side of the remonstrants, the Arminian camp, whereas those who were much more in the middle working class and the lower class were loyal to the counter-remonstrants and the Calvinists. By 1617, these conflicts really were beginning to tear the Dutch Republic apart. It looked as if a civil war was going to happen between these two camps. The predominant remonstrant civil authorities were banning Calvinist counter-remonstrant preachers and any other meetings that they were having outside their church. Many lay people began leaving these remonstrants, these Arminian-led churches, to go to a more Calvinist church, but because those were being banned, they would meet in like farmhouses and places like that, but the civil authorities also banned those meetings. The Prime Minister, Oldenbarnevelt, issued his famous Sharp Resolution at this time, which declared the supreme power of the government over church matters and argued that troops could be recruited to attack any opposition to the remonstrants. And so this is the idea where now physical force can be utilized, military force can be utilized to basically squash down the counter-remonstrants. And this was not looking good for the counter-remonstrants at this side, who really was primarily led by the church leaders, not so many political leaders. But that all changed when Maurice of Orange, of the famous Orange House there in the Dutch Republic, sided with the counter-remonstrants. Now, this was out of no theological conviction. He basically said from the beginning, I can't explain to you or I don't know anything about predestination. That is something that is just beyond me. I don't know and really could care less about the matter. Maurice of Orange really saw this more as an opportunity to seize power and to really gain his own political movement in the sense by siding with the counter-remonstrants. Now, during this time, there were seven provinces in the Dutch Republic. And the two most powerful were under the control of the provinces, of the remonstrants. Now, that left five more that were open. And Maurice went and took control and gained the support of the other five. And remember, this is a republic, the Dutch Republic. And so the provinces all have a state general that is over them, that kind of serves as their representative. And these generals all took a vote, and it became a majority vote, which sided on the counter-remonstrants. Why? Because Maurice had gained the support of five of them. So now you have a 5-2 majority that goes to the counter-remonstrants, and this radically changes things. The provincial states gave Maurice the power to disarm the troops of the remonstrants that had been raised up by Oldenbarnevelt. And so this took a huge shift in the scene of things. What once looked like it was going to go very well for the remonstrants now had turned, and Maurice the Orange had come in on the side of the counter-remonstrants and through this Republican vote had gained the power and handed the power back to the Dutch Reformed Church in maintaining its independence. Most of the remonstrance leaders were imprisoned, and Oldenbarnevelt was executed at the age of 72 years of age. And with the political strife now under control, Maurice and the States Generals moved to now resolve the religious issue of between Arminianism and Calvinism, and they did so by summoning one of the most important synods in church history. And this synod is known as the Synod of Dort. The synod was composed of 56 ministers and elders and 5 professors with 18 political commissioners to report back to the States Generals. Now, Reformed theologians from all over Europe were invited to attend the Synod of Dort. And this was done in hopes that this synod would establish the Reformed opinion worldwide. They wanted a synod that not only reflected Dutch Reformed Orthodoxy, but Reformed Orthodoxy as a whole. And so 30 delegates came from Germany, Switzerland, Britain, and the French Reformed churches. Only 13 remonstrance leaders were allowed to appear, but they were not allowed to appear as delegates. Rather, they appeared as plaintiffs on trial for doctrinal error. Since the remonstrants had expressed Arminian theology in 5 points, the synod responded by working through these points a series of canons known as the Canons of Dort and presented a Reformed perspective on each point specifically. And it is here that we have the origin of the so-called 5 points of Calvinism, which was not a summary of Reformed theology, but rather simply Reformed theology's response to Arminian theology. Now, that's very important. The 5 points of Calvinism do not outline or do not mean that that is the fullness of Reformed theology. It's far more than that. Reformed orthodoxy is more than just whether or not you hold or subscribe to the 5 points of Calvinism. And that is a very important concept to grasp. And so, the summary of these 5 points have been basically brought together in this very well-known and commonly given acrostic known as TULIP. So the Synod agreed with the Arminians on total depravity. That's the T, right? Which is basically the idea that all of mankind is born in original sin and is in bondage to their fallen human will. The fallen human will is enslaved and in bondage and cannot reach to God, cannot achieve salvation on its own whatsoever. That God has to act in order to enable man and his deadness to respond to him in faith. So the Calvinists agree with the Arminians on total depravity. And so that's the first point. The second point is that of unconditional election. That's where you get the U from in TULIP. And the reason why it was unconditional is because God's election, God's choosing for salvation, according to the Calvinists, was not based on any kind of foreknowledge of any action or characteristic of an individual. But it's also important to note that the Synod of Dort was very infralapsarian. So it rejected the supralapsarianism. I shouldn't say necessarily rejected, but it argued for an infralapsarian approach. When you look at the Canons of Dort, you see that God elects out of the pool of fallen humanity. That means that his election is post his decree to allow, to permit the fall. And so God chooses individuals who are fallen, who are on their way to hell. God chooses to save a people from every tribe, tongue, and nation for his own goodwill and purposes. That is his glorious reason and glorious purpose in doing so. And so this is God's glorious purpose of unconditional election. It is not based upon anything other than his own goodwill, glory, and purposes. That is the idea of the Calvinist doctrine of election. Thirdly, the L, limited atonement, also known as particular redemption. And this was the idea that though the death of Christ was sufficient to save the whole of humanity, by God's sovereign will, it was only particularly effectual in saving the elect. So though Christ's death is sufficient to save every single person, it is the death of the Savior, the death of God the Son, it is sufficient for all, it is efficient or effectual, it actually saves the elect to whom the redeeming, atoning power of his death was applied to by the sovereign grace of God. The third point is that of irresistible grace. That is, that saving grace is not resistible. Because saving grace changes hearts. It opens eyes. It removes blindness. It removes deafness. And so for the Calvinist, it cannot be resisted. When God truly changes heart, when He makes someone born again, you don't make yourself unborn. So you are new. You're giving new life. And so just as you can't go back into your mom and resist your physical birth, your natural birth, for the Calvinist, you cannot resist your spiritual birth. It is something that God grants irresistibly to those He chooses to apply it to. And then finally, it argued for the perseverance of the saints. That's the P. That is to say, that those who are truly born again, those who God has elected, those who God has saved, He will ensure their security. They can be assured of their eternal security. They will persevere to the end. That what God has begun, He will complete. And so these were the 5 points of the counter-remonstrance against the Arminian points of theology shown earlier. It is important to note that the canons of Dort are much longer than those 5 points. There's a lot there in the canons of Dort, and they're far more detailed than just those simple 5 points seen in that commonly used acrostic. The Synod of Dort concluded on May 9, 1619, and it became the final authoritative confession of the Dutch Reformed Church, along with the Belgic Confession and the Heidelberg Catechism. And together, those statements of faith were known as the Three Forms of Unity. There were 1,100 pastors in the Dutch Republic, in the Dutch Reformed Church at the time, and 190 of them were deposed for refusing to subscribe to the canon. So you can see that the Reformed Orthodox reproach of the Counter-Remonstrance always was the majority view in the Dutch Reformed Church. And out of those 190 who originally were deposed because they refused to sign, 40 of them actually recanted and were restored, eventually accepting the points made by the canons of Dort. Over time, however, the remonstrance was allowed tolerance and was actually given a legal recognition back in the Dutch Republic in the year 1795. So Arminianism, it would never really truly die out per se. It would eventually be given actual official toleration and would be very influential, we'll see, in Wesleyanism. And that brings us to our final controversy. So that was the Arminian controversy. And now we turn to a controversy that kind of occurred and really is the debate that never died in many ways. And that is the controversy of Emeraldianism. The Reformed world was far more convulsed by Emeraldianism than it was by Arminianism. This was primarily because it was easy to see that Arminianism was not compatible with Reformed orthodoxy, with Reformed theology. But this was much more difficult with the case of Emeraldianism. For instance, even Francis Turretin, who is by far the trumpet of Reformed Orthodoxy and the greatest critic of Emeraldianism, even he argued that Emeraldians were Reformed thinkers, even though he disagreed with their views vehemently. And so this was a big issue. As a debate within the Reformed world, it began to provoke a question that is still very prominent today. And that question is this: what does it mean to hold to Reformed theology? What does it mean to be Reformed? And that is a question that still plagues really many in the Reformed world today. Emeraldianism takes its name from the French Huguenot theologian Moïse Emerald. He was deeply influenced by both John Calvin and the Scottish theologian, a man by the name of John Cameron. And it was Cameron that ultimately served most vital in the formation of Amerot's theological stance. Our Ameronianism could in many ways be called Cameronianism. As when you look at John Cameron's theology, it is almost identical to what you will find later on with his disciple Amerot. By 1634, Amerot was becoming well known among French Protestants as a distinguished theologian. And it was that year that he published a treatise that really took the Reformed world by storm. This treatise, this work, is entitled The Brief Treatise on Predestination and Its Dependent Principles. In this work, Amerot primarily sought to counter the supralapsarian view of predestination. Amerot, being there in France, in a minority group, heard from many Catholics that the Calvinist God was capricious. He was unjust, unloving, and that he believed this was a hindrance to their conversion to the Reformed faith. He thought, if we can simply make this concept more palatable, this will win many over from the Catholic system of thinking. So Amerot sought to defend the doctrine of predestination by arguing that election should be viewed in light of the cross of Christ rather than the cross of Christ in light of election. According to Amerot, the moving cause behind the coming of Christ was God's love for the entire human race without any limitation. The salvation that Christ procured for humanity, however, must be received personally through faith. However, Amerot argued that such faith is beyond the power of the human will, which was in agreement with all the camps at this point. Therefore, election was God's sovereign decision to give faith efficaciously to some sinners in order that Christ's universal mission would bear fruit among fallen humankind. Amerot believed that he had woven together God's general love for humanity, the universal applicability of Christ's atonement, and divine sovereignty in salvation in a system that he believed was more faithful to Calvin than what the current Reformed Orthodoxy at the time was holding to. This system became known as hypothetical universalism. That is to say, that Christ died for all, and therefore, hypothetically, all could be saved, but all wouldn't be saved because of the fall, and so God had elected individuals to give faith to from every tribe, tongue, and nation to ensure that indeed Christ's atoning work would bear fruit. In this system, Amerot argued with both the supralapsarian and infralapsarian order of decrees. For Amerot, the order of God's decrees were as such. First, God decrees to create all humanity. Secondly, God decrees to permit the fall. Thirdly, rather than now electing individuals like the infralapsarian view, Amerot argues that God decrees the mission of Christ to save humanity with its effects conditional on faith. So he goes, God creates the permits the decrees the fall, or decrees creation, God decrees the fall, God decrees the plan of salvation to save all of humanity in the death of Christ, and then lastly, God decrees to elect individuals in order, by giving them faith in order that Christ's mission would bear fruit. So this election is not like Arminianism, which sees who will have faith. Rather, this election is real election in that God chooses to give faith to to a people from every tribe, tongue, and nation in order that they would experience the atoning work of Christ, which was offered for all mankind. And so this was very important because one of the critiques of the system of what you would say is against limited atonement is the idea of the divide that it would create in the Godhead. If God had unconditionally elected individuals for salvation, then why would he put the entire sin of the world on Christ, knowing that he was only going to save his elect? Well, Amarok's theology finds really a road around that. And that is to say, he argues that God's decree to save all through the atoning death of Christ, or to provide an atonement for all because of his general love for all, precedes his election of individuals to saving faith, so that the salvation offered by Christ would truly bear fruit. Whereas in fallen humanity, it would likely not bear fruit because of man's inability, fallen man's inability to believe and to pursue and to seek the things of God. And this became vital because this revealed another aspect of Amarok's theology that attracted criticism and both support. And this was Amarok's distinction between natural ability and moral ability or spiritual ability. Amarok argued that all of mankind has the natural ability or natural capacity to believe in God. Otherwise, for Amarok, it would be unjust for God to command them to believe. But what man lacks is the spiritual capacity to believe in God because of the effects of the fall. So all men have the natural capacity to believe. They still have cognitive function. They still have rationality. They still have reason. Even though those are fallen, they still have the ability to choose God naturally. But spiritually, they are incapable of choosing God because spiritually, they are dead in sin. His opponents, however, argued that Amarok was diluting the Reformed view of human depravity. They argued, if human nature was corrupted by sin, then how could human ability not be the same as natural inability? So if human nature is fallen, not just the spiritual aspect of man, but all the aspects of man, how could spiritual incapacity also not be seen as a natural incapacity? How could not the fullness of man be broken or be condemned or be dead in the fall in the sense of totally incapable of pursuing the things of God? This was the major critique against Amarok's view. Is all mankind fallen and broken, or is simply the spiritual function of man dead and therefore incapable of pursuing the things of God? They believe that Amarok wasn't taking depravity far enough. They argued that such conditionality was inconsistent with God's sovereignty. And this really came into regards to the nature of Christ's death and it being conditional on the basis of people's faith. So if Christ's death is still conditioned upon faith, then isn't that incompatible with the doctrine of election? Isn't it incompatible with God's sovereignty and salvation if he makes the condition of his salvation based upon human responsibility? These were some of the major critiques of the Reformed opponents of Amarok. Many of these opponents, like Pierre de Moulin, argued that Amarokianism was merely crypto-Arminianism, and were enraged when Amarokianism swore their allegiance to the canons of Dort. Amarokianism became a stronghold of the French Huguenots, pretty much predominantly became the French French Huguenot and the French Calvinist, French Reformed view. Amirautianism really took France by storm, but it also spread into other parts of the Reformed world. England especially produced a rich crop of Amirautians or sympathizers who constructed similar outlooks. These individuals were men like Stephen Marshall, Richard Vines, Edmund Calamy, John Howe, and Richard Baxter. Now, it's not sure how influential Amirot was on these individuals, but they all espoused very similar views to that which is found in Amirautianism. In 1637, the French Reformed Church held a national synod that investigated the views of Amirot. Amirot answered all of the questions they posed to him with lots of clarity. He was very concise, very honest with the questions that were asked, and very clear about his theological stances, and he continued to swear allegiance to the canons of Dort. Ultimately, the synod exonerated him of any doctrinal error, but did caution him against using certain phrases like conditional decrees, which they believed could be misunderstood and could lead to heresy. Now, this was an astonishing victory for Amirot and a fellow pastor named Paul Tester, both of them holding to Amirot's views. This was a huge victory. They had been brought to a trial for heresy and absolutely exonerated, even though that they did have views that clearly were a variation from the infralapsarian views of the canons of Dort. And there's a lot of argument as to why this happened. Many people argue that it was because the French Reformed Church was already having to deal with its own, was dealing with its issue of being a minority in a majority Catholic country. And so the last thing they wanted was to divide their already minority church. They wanted to try to maintain unity as much as possible. Others think that it was primarily because of the fact of just how well Amirot showed up, that nobody thought that he was going to be able to be as clear, as concise, as direct, as honest, and as intellectual as he proved himself to be. And so many think that they were just taken aside by how really well-versed, how well-thought-out Amirot's arguments were. And then another argument is that it's primarily, the reason that they were exonerated was because most of their opposition came from other countries, Reformed leaders of other countries, whereas the vast majority of the French Reformed Church fell right in line with what Amirot and Amirotianism was teaching. Amirotianism would remain a point of contention among the Reformed world, but perhaps the most important critique of Amirot's theology came from Francis Turretin, who even conceded that Amirot was himself Reformed, but not purely Reformed. And so here you start seeing that distinction, that individuals can be Reformed, but not purely Reformed. And this really begins to be an idea espoused by Turretin and many today. Arminianism would forever be seen as divorced from Reformed theology, almost the antagonist of Reformed theology. For a while, it was either you're a Calvinist or you're an Arminianist. That was really the two opposing sides. There was a clear-cut line of division. But that was not the case with Amirotianism. Anytime there has ever been friction over the extent of Christ's atonement within Reformed circles, the theology of Amirot remains pertinent and influential. It is a vital and influential debate that is still happening very much within Reformed circles today. And so these were the major controversies of the Reformed Orthodox world, the controversy of Arminianism and the controversy of Amiraldianism. And in many ways, like I said earlier, neither one of these debates really ever died, but would be given, Arminianism would be given a new life and a new light with the rise of Wesleyan thinking and Wesleyanism, and Amiraldianism would always maintain a vital influence, not only within the French Reformed Church, but other Reformed circles still today. So that was the Reformed controversy, the major controversy in Reformed Orthodoxy. And next week, as we gather together next time, we will be looking at the British Isles. We'll be turning our attention away from continental Europe and towards the British Isles. And we will begin next week looking at the rise of the Puritans.